This episode is supported in part by the Center for Environmental Law at Loyola University, New Orleans, advocating for healthy communities and a sustainable Gulf Coast.
Imagine Mordor, and honestly, that's what it looks like. If you Google tar sands, Alberta, Canada, it's just this totally devastating landscape. And when you have pipelines, you have pipeline spills. And this is well documented over and over and over again.
Welcome to Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform with your host, Rob Virchik.
Here's a puzzle. Name one thing that connects climate activists to advocates of indigenous rights to the environmental health and safety community. How about oil pipelines? Or more specifically, opposition to oil pipelines. These days, there are proposals for thousands and thousands of miles of new pipelines through North America. And as pipelines expand across North America, through Canada and the United States, they bring a lot of fossil fuel, and environmental activists are joining with social justice activists and First Nation peoples and Native Americans in the United States to cut off climate change-inducing oil and gas at the source. To find out more about this, I invited Rachel Rye Butler to speak with me today. She leads the campaign for Greenpeace's democracy work in the United States. Before joining Greenpeace USA, Rachel was with the Sierra Club, and she also served on the organizing teams for large-scale mobilizations like the People's Climate March and the Forward on Climate Rally in 2013. I reached Rachel recently at her office in Oakland, California, via Skype, and we talked about all kinds of related issues, from the devastation of climate change, the economics of oil pipelines in North America, the inspiring work of First Nation peoples and Native Americans in the United States, and the rays of hopes that she sees in the future. Rachel Butler, welcome to Connect the Dots. So I've got a map in front of me on my desk called the Crude Oil Pipeline Map of recent pipeline projects all over North America. And the continent is just full of lines squiggling everywhere. The Kinder Mountain Trans Mountain Pipeline from Alberta to British Columbia, Keystone XL from Alberta to Nebraska, the Bayou Bridge Pipeline from Lake Charles to St. James, Louisiana. Why all this interest in oil and gas pipelines at the moment?
I think that's a great question. And it really gets to the heart of what we as a country in the US and also largely what's happening in North America around oil and gas production. We've seen this explosion of oil and gas production in the US at the same time as the tar sands industry in Canada has been very, very diligently trying to build pipeline capacity to get their products to market. I'm going to focus in on the tar sands just for a second, because that's one place where we've seen an industry that is hugely polluting, both in terms of climate, in terms of water, in terms of land destruction, in terms of human and environmental health impacts, in terms of impact on the community. And tar sands, for listeners who don't know, tar sands is one of the most extreme sources of oil on the planet. What it is actually isn't even really oil in its natural state. It's actually more like little particles of asphalt that are mixed in with the sand. And in order to get it out of the ground, it either has to be mined with these massive pieces of machinery, or it has to be literally cooked out of the ground by injecting steam, getting those little asphalt particles to melt, and then pumping them out of the ground. So it's a just getting that tar sands out of the ground is a hugely energy-intensive process, huge amount of climate emissions, huge amount of water pollution that's going into the tar sands. But here's the thing.
I should just mention you're destroying a lot of forests, arboreal forests in North America too, right? Which, of course, are carbon sinks and keep the carbon dioxide from being in the atmosphere.
Yes, that's absolutely right. There have been changes in the way that tar sands are mined and processed. And that's something that the tar sands industry really likes to tout, that, oh, we've gotten so much better. But the fact is, any way you look at it, the tar sands are this hugely destructive industrial project. If you want to see what they look like, if you're listening along at home, just imagine Mordor. This is often what I like to tell people. Imagine Mordor, and honestly, that's what it looks like. If you Google tar sands, Alberta, Canada, it's just this totally devastating landscape that's just been totally destroyed by this kind of industrial project, this really extreme source of oil. But here's the thing with the tar sands, and here's the thing with any kind of oil development, is that you have to get the oil, you have to get it somewhere, you have to move it somewhere in order for it to be refined, in order for it to be processed. And in the tar sands, the capacity has been constrained by the amount of pipelines that go from the tar sands in Alberta to refineries and out for export. So in the last decade, there's been a big push to build additional tar sands pipelines so that the tar sands industry can expand. They're really pipeline constrained. And that's one of the big strategies, one of the really successful strategies of this indigenous-led movement that has been working to stop the tar sands, that's been working to keep fossil fuels in the ground, is this movement, this strategy that if we can stop these pipelines from being built, that stops the expansion of these really dangerous kinds of fossil fuels.
Well, so tell me, what is the problem with the pipelines? I suppose that there's a problem with more combustion and having more carbon emitted into the air when these petroleum products are burned. But is there an environmental problem with the pipelines themselves?
Absolutely. There is no safe pipeline. There is no safe way to transport oil. And when you have pipelines, you have pipeline spills. And this is well documented over and over and over again. Pipelines spill, pipelines leak. When you build a pipeline, you are signing up for oil spills. And when you have oil spills, that's a problem for the water, when the fuel that's leaked, when the tar sands gets into the water, that's a huge problem. It's a problem for the land. It's a problem for the communities. Often when you have pipeline spills, you have a lot of human impacts that go along with that. You have people that end up getting sick and going to the hospital because of exposure to crude oil or exposure to the cancer-causing chemicals that they mix in with the tar sands to dilute it and get it to move through a pipeline. So absolutely, there are lots of problems with pipelines themselves in terms of land, water, climate, and human health.
One constituency that has been protesting the development of some of these pipelines are the First Nation peoples in Canada and Native Americans in the United States. Can you explain a little bit more about what their specific concerns are and then how they are organizing and advocating against the development of these pipelines?
Sure. What I can say is that the movement to stop pipelines from being built has been an Indigenous-led movement from the get-go. And I'm not going to speak for any of these communities, but what I can say is that the most successful movements that we've seen to stop these pipelines, to stop this destruction, to stop the tar sands, those have been movements that have Indigenous leadership, because the First Nations folks, the Indigenous peoples, they are on the front lines, not only of the extraction, not only are they on the front lines of where this oil is being pumped out of the ground, but often they're on the front lines of where these pipelines travel through. And we've seen that over and over with pipelines being sited in or near tribal communities, crossing tribal lands. Standing Rock was a very explicit example of that, of a pipeline route that was changed to avoid a large white population center and instead sited near a Native community and a Native community's water source. So often these Native communities are on the front lines of both extraction and of pipelines, and by following the leadership of these communities who are standing up for themselves and standing up for their health, their rights, their sovereignty. That's been the way that that a lot of these pipeline fights have been able to stop pipelines from being built.
Can you say a little bit about how organizations like yours get involved in supporting local efforts like the indigenous groups you're describing?
So often there are indigenous groups or specific indigenous leaders that are at the center of these fights. And at Greenpeace, we're well known for direct action. We're well known for some of the things that we've done, like just this past year, helping to stop or do this blockade of the Trans Mountain Pipeline, of one of the tar sands tankers that would have that was trying to leave the terminal at the tar sands the tar sands terminus in Burnaby, Canada, and try to go out to sea to make this delivery of tar sands that was coming from the Trans Mountain Pipeline.
This is a port just outside of Vancouver, is that right?
Yes.
On the west coast of British Columbia?
Yep, okay. Exactly. So the sort of to back up a couple of steps in the question here, the Trans Mountain Pipeline crosses the lands of many different First Nations in Canada. And Greenpeace has worked directly with some members of these First Nations to help support and to lift up and get more people involved in supporting these fights to stop pipelines. One of the ways that we got involved in the last year was through this particular action to stop a delivery of this tar sand shipment that was coming from a terminal just outside Vancouver and trying to get to sea. For those of you who know Vancouver, you'll know that there are some very narrow passages, these bridges that any ships that are going out to sea have to pass under. And that's a really great way to put a blockade on those bridges so that it stops the ships from going out to sea. So there are situations like that when we are working directly with members of impacted communities and really trying to lift up the voices so these communities are able to speak for themselves. And really, I think that's the key, is that is to lift up the leadership and to lift up the voices of people who are on the front lines of these fights.
Can you tell me a little bit about how that actually might happen in real life? I mean, you or others at Greenpeace, you go to community meetings, and how does the discussion unfold?
You know, every campaign is different. But often it follows a path of building relationships with people who are on the front lines of these fights, figuring out where a big global organization like Greenpeace can play a role for support. Sometimes that's in the case of helping to organize the direct action. Sometimes that means getting a global membership of people to put pressure on the financial institutions that are funding the pipeline. Sometimes that's getting meetings with the leaders of those financial institutions and then inviting in members of the communities that we work with. So it looks a lot of different ways for this question of in real life, what does this look like? But honestly, what it looks like is a lot of talking with a lot of different people and figuring out where we have shared interests and how we can support both support the people who are on the ground and also how we can tackle these bigger systems that are supporting pipeline development, like the financial, like the finance institutions, so that we can be successful in stopping these pipelines in order to protect the climate, protect the water, and protect these communities that that we live in and that our friends live in.
Let's take a break. Now, listeners, if you like our conversations on CPR's Connect the Dots, you will love the conversations on our blog post, CPR blog. That's where you'll find our own law and policy experts talking about everything from regulatory shenanigans in Washington, D.C., to the fight for safety in the workplace, to the relationship between, presidential emergency powers and climate change. So check us out. We're at www.progressivereform.org. When we come back, we'll talk about why some companies are still investing in oil pipelines and why the Canadian government just bought one.
I walked up on a mountain in the middle of the sky. Could see every farm and every town. I could see all the people in this whole wide world. That's a union that'll tear the fascists down, down, down. That's a union that'll tear the fascists down. When I think of the men and the ships going down while the Russians fight on across the Don, there's London in ruins and Paris in chains. Good people, what are we waiting on? Good people, what are we waiting on? So I thank the Soviets and the mighty Chinese vets, the allies, the whole wide world around. To the battling British, thanks, you can have 10 million Yanks if it takes them to tear the fascists down, down, down. If it takes them to tear the fascists.
So tell me a little bit more about talking to the financial institutions, because I noticed that Greenpeace actually has issued some reports about the financing of these pipelines and actually about the future of the oil and gas economy, I suppose. What do you say to banks or other lenders who are currently funding these petroleum pipeline projects or that might be in the future? How do you discourage them, I suppose, from expanding their holdings in this kind of a portfolio?
It's a great question, and one that's really relevant, because especially in the political climate right now, we're not able to rely on a lot of the institutions that we should be able to rely on in order to protect us from things like extreme weather that are related to fossil fuel development. But the thing is that pipelines take a lot of money to build, and there are these big financial institutions like JP Morgan Chase, for example, who is one of the biggest funders of tar sands and other kinds of extreme fossil fuels that's out there. And these pipelines, these companies, they rely on money from these big financial institutions. Just in the last year, Greenpeace has put out a report about the dirty dozen financial institutions that are funding tar sands, that are funding Energy Transfer, the company behind Dakota Access Pipeline, and putting pressure on these financial institutions to stop funding or to not to fund tar sands and not to fund Energy Transfer because of the kinds of practices that they're using and because of the kind of damage that they do by building pipelines. So one of the ways that we were able to put pressure on these big financial institutions that are giving money to companies that are building pipelines is by getting a lot of people together. Just in the last year, we've had over 400,000 people across the globe sign the petition to these dirty dozen banks, asking them not to fund these kinds of dangerous tar sands projects. And that kind of pressure, it means something. Banks don't want to be associated with human rights abuses. They don't want to be associated with climate destruction. And when they know that people are paying attention, that gets them to sit up, that gets them to listen and lean in. The other thing is that a lot of these banks, they have public commitments around climate change. They are on the record saying they support the Paris Climate Agreement. They're on record saying that they care about a safe climate. They care about 1.5 degree limit on climate pollution. They care about human rights abuses. They're on record. They have policies that show what their public stance is. So when we're able to do the research, talk to the people, put together the reports that show that what they're funding, that these pipelines that they're funding, that these companies that they're funding are in direct opposition to the policies that they say they have, that means something too.
I wonder sometimes about what is motivating lenders in this space, and in fact, sometimes about the economic decisions, the financial decisions that oil and gas companies make. There was, for instance, a recent oil and gas consultancy, a very influential Wood Mackenzie made the prediction that in the next within the next 20 years, we'll see the global peak of oil demand. And that makes me think, well, if that's going to happen in the next 10 to 20 years, there's an awful lot of investment going into producing more and more expensive ways of putting oil on the market, whether that means getting oil out of the tar sands, which you explained is so difficult, or getting oil 2 miles under the sea down in the Gulf of Mexico, or in extreme conditions in the Arctic Circle. And I wonder why companies and the banks that fund them are so interested in spending so much money on recovering oil that really there might not be such a demand for in the next 20 years. What do you make of that? And when you talk to banks like JP Morgan Chase, do you feel like that anyone understands that message, or have I got something wrong? Maybe this assumption about peak oil is wrong in their minds. How do you react to that?
I think you're absolutely right. The energy agencies, the governmental agencies who are doing research about oil are forecasting a decline in oil demand. We saw this play out in Minnesota just recently with the Line 3 tar sands pipeline that another tar sands pipeline company, Enbridge, is wanting to build across the state of Minnesota. And when they applied for their permits, it wasn't just the environmentalists, it wasn't just the First Nations folks who are saying, the indigenous folks in Minnesota who are saying, we don't need this pipeline. It was actually the Minnesota Department of Commerce's own analysis, their own research that said, actually, Minnesota doesn't need this tar sands oil based on the demand, based on demand forecasts. We actually think instead of, and this is the Department of Commerce, the Minnesota Department of Commerce saying this, we actually think that instead of building this new tar sands pipeline, you shouldn't issue permits, state of Minnesota, to build this new tar sands pipeline. And in fact, the old Line 3, the old tar sands pipeline that Enbridge wants to be replaced, should be shut down. And that is the Minnesota Department of Commerce saying there isn't the demand. Instead of building a new pipeline, the old pipeline should be shut down. That is a huge deal. And that's exactly what you're saying, that the demand forecast for oil does not look good for the oil companies. So that leads to the question of why, as you're saying, like, why are we still seeing this this desire, this big push from oil companies to build pipelines, and why are we seeing governments approve them?
And why do you think that is?
I think there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one is that there's a huge capture of government by the fossil fuel industry. We know that it's been so difficult to get rid of subsidies for the fossil fuel industry because of that capture of regulators, that capture of lawmakers, just the influence of fossil fuel companies in our government. That influence is still hugely powerful, and we're making progress on that. We're chipping away at it. But the fact is that they still have a lot of money, and they throw that money around in ways that allow them to win out over the voice of the people, and also over logic about the survival of our species.
So I have to ask you about this, and you probably knew I was going to bring it up, but the issue is jobs, right? I mean, I suppose you could say, yeah, all of this is true. Oil demand is going to peak at some point, 10, 20 years, maybe it's going to be beyond that. And you could even say, which is absolutely true, that there are going to be thousands, really millions of jobs that are going to be created by a green economy transition, some of which is already occurring right now, and that many more jobs are going to be created than the jobs that are lost. I think that's a pretty safe assumption. We have lots of studies that show that. But the one thing we also know is that some people are going to lose jobs. So as progressives, how should we look at that problem? Do you think that we progressives do enough to think about the issues of unemployment like this?
I think this is a really key question about the, you know, we have this opportunity right now. That's, it's absolutely a crisis, but it's also an opportunity to build a better system, to build a different kind of world where people are taken care of as well as the environment. And I think the question that you're raising really gets at the importance of a just transition. And what I hear from people that I work with, from organizations that I work with, especially those who are working directly on the front lines of the climate crisis, is about the importance of a just transition as part of our move away from fossil fuels and our move into clean energy, locally based energy. And I think it's really important to really think about what that means, what a just transition means. It's really important to trust the people who are on the front lines to tell us what does a just transition mean to you. And it's not just about building, you know, giant solar farms, for example, like those, that's one way of doing it. But neighborhood-based renewable energy projects, that's a totally different way of doing it that does end up changing the system, putting more power into the hands of people, instead of just, you know, continuing the status quo that that we have right now. So I think, you know, as we are transitioning away from a fossil fuel-based economy, those questions of a just transition are really key. They're really important. We can put so many people to work building the clean energy infrastructure that we need today. We can put so many people to work doing that. And at the same time, that has to include a just transition, that has to include the people who are currently living and working in a fossil fuel-based economy, and making sure that we can put people to work, not just those who are already working, but we have a huge opportunity in this country right now to build the kind of clean energy, renewable energy solutions, neighborhood-based, clean transportation. We have this huge opportunity to tackle this problem in a way that's going to put a lot of people to work with good union jobs, good paying jobs, jobs that allow people to take care of their families at the same time as we are keeping fossil fuels in the ground, because that, as we've talked about, that it is a risk for our climate, it's a risk for the water, it has health impacts for communities. So I think there's a big opportunity for us in the really scary, heavy news with the IPCC report saying, you know, we've got about a decade to deal with climate change. Otherwise, you know, we're in real trouble.
Fair enough. Tell me some good news from the front line.
Especially when talking about fighting tar sands pipelines, in the last decade, there has not been one of the five tar sands pipelines that have been proposed, not one of those has been built in the last decade. And that's largely thanks to this indigenous-led movement. And it's a really successful strategy, because by stopping these pipelines from being built, you're stopping the expansion of this, of the tar sands, of this super disastrous form of energy, to the point right now where the there are tar sands producers up in Alberta who are making the choice to cut production because they aren't making the money that they need to make. It's actually costing them more to produce a barrel of tar sands than it is that they can sell it for. So the strategy is working. You know, by fighting these fights at the local level, we are not always able to win, but there are a lot of places where we're changing the tide. And one of the, with the Trans Mountain pipeline, the one that would have gone from Alberta through unceded Indigenous lands in British Columbia, And then to the export terminal in Burnaby, right outside Vancouver. And from that point, you know, people like to think about the pipeline ending on land, but that's not the case. At that point, the tar sands would have been loaded onto ships, shipped out through the Salish Sea, through the Puget Sound, and down to refineries in Washington State and in California. Most of that tar sands is coming to the U.S., and every single one of those tankers is a risk for having a spill and polluting and contaminating the water and the environment. And so the Kinder Morgan pipeline, this company Kinder Morgan, was planning to build another tar sands pipeline that would increase the capacity of the existing pipeline that's there. And they met with so much resistance from the First Nations, from people living in British Columbia, from people living all over Canada, from people living in the U.S., from people living in the Pacific Northwest, to say, we don't want this pipeline. And it got to the point where Kinder Morgan, the company that was proposing it, decided that, you know what, this is not worth it. This is going to cost too much money, so we're out. They abandoned the project. They decided we are going to step away from this pipeline. It's not worth it. That is one of the largest pipeline companies in North America saying it is not worth it to build this pipeline.
Justin Trudeau's government bought it, though, right?
Kinder Morgan decided we're walking away. It's not worth it. And then in a $4.5 billion purchase of Canadian taxpayer money, Justin Trudeau's government decided that they are going to buy the pipeline, not even a pipeline that's built already, but they're going to buy the existing pipeline and then the new pipeline that is yet to be built. They're going to use taxpayer money to buy that pipeline from Texas-based Kinder Morgan. So that's $4.5 billion of Canadian taxpayer money that just got given to a Texas-based pipeline company. Really bad deal for Canadians.
Why did they do that?
Why did they do it is a great question that a lot of Canadians are currently asking Justin Trudeau's administration. Here's the interesting thing. The Canadian government wants to sell the pipeline to another buyer. Here's the thing. There is not another buyer that has stepped forward. The Canadian government says, okay, we'll take this Kinder Morgan company that was building the pipeline. We'll buy this pipeline from you, and then we want to sell it to another company. But no other company has stepped up. So now the Canadian government is left holding this hot potato of a pipeline that is never going to get built because of the public opposition, the First Nations who have not given their consent to this project going through their lands. And the Canadian government is now holding this hot potato, this $4.5 billion hot potato of a pipeline that's not going to get built. So that is a very interesting story and one that I think we're going to see playing out many different times in many different ways in the future.
Wow. You and I, even though we are both advocates on environmental issues, we're at different ends of the telescope, maybe. You work a lot with local communities at the grassroots level. And as a law professor and as a policy advocate, I work on the side of thinking through issues in terms of what good policies might be or in terms of what sorts of laws already exist that might be used in new ways by lawyers or by decision makers in government. And I heard you say just now when you were talking about the just transition, really about the role of government. And before you were talking about the role of government, you were talking about, for instance, trying to persuade companies and banks in the private sector. And one of the things from that conversation that struck me was, one, markets aren't just going to fix the problem themselves just because it might not make sense for investment to take place doesn't mean it won't, because there are a lot of entrenched ways of doing things, and there are a lot of subsidies built in to government programs that encourage the wrong things sometimes. So what is it that you at the at the end of the telescope that you're working on, okay, with local people and advocates like yourselves who are on the ground, what is it that you could use most from people on my end of the telescope, people who are thinking in terms of new legal frameworks or new policy initiatives? What could we do that would be more helpful to you and the local people who are directly affected by environmental problems?
This is a great question. And I think we could probably spend the entire rest of the hour talking about this. But I think there are, you know, there are a couple of really key points that I would want to really emphasize. And I said this previously, but really trusting the front lines, trusting the people who are at the forefront of the impacts, who are at the forefront of, you know, fossil fuel infrastructure being built in their backyard, and also those who are at the forefront of the climate impacts, that are experiencing the impacts of extreme weather that are that's linked to climate change. There are lots of different ways of tackling this really big problem that we have to solve, and it's going to take all of us to do it. So I think, you know, as we're working to tackle this problem, to solve climate change, to do that in a way that incorporates a just transition, really trusting the front lines and knowing that we are all using different tools in the toolbox, and all of those tools are valid and all of those tools are important. Everything from nonviolent direct action to lawsuits, all of those tools are tools that we're going to need to deal with climate change and to build a society that can withstand the impacts and, in the next 10 years, stop using fossil fuels. Let's avoid the worst impacts.
I want to end our interview today by asking if what rays of hope you see in this struggle for the environment, because you seem awfully committed and very energized by this. So what is it that gets you up in the morning? What rays of hope do you see in your activism?
I think, to me, the rays of hope are the people who are on the front lines of these fights. And when I say front lines, like I want to be really specific about what I mean there. These are people who are, there are people who are on the front lines in Oakland, California. There are people who are on the front lines in New Orleans, in Louisiana. There are people who are on the front lines in Vancouver. There are people on the front lines who are in Minnesota along Line 3. These front lines are many, many, many different places. Like we all, to some degree, are experiencing the impacts of fossil fuel infrastructure in our backyards and the impacts of extreme weather that are linked to climate change. So, and there are some folks who are really tuned into that, who are the activists, who are fighting for their communities, who are fighting for the right to clean air, the right to clean water, and the right for a safe climate. And these are folks that will not give up. They will not give up, because having a safe climate, having clean water, having safe communities, these things are too important. These are people who are fighting for their families. They're people who are fighting for their friends. And I count myself as one of them. And I count myself really lucky to be surrounded by such an amazing and powerful group of people who are getting up every day and saying, it's looking really dark out there, but we think we can build something that's going to bring us some light. So I count myself very lucky to be surrounded by such strong people. And really it's those bonds. It's those bonds of care and those bonds of friendship that really get me up in the morning and keep me coming back to fight this fight.
Well said. Well, thank you very much, Rachel Butler, for talking with me today.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Waiting on
And that concludes my interview with Rachel Butler of Greenpeace USA. Make sure to tell your friends and colleagues about CPR's Connect the Dots. You can follow me on Twitter. I love that. At Rob Verchik. I'll follow you back, too. Many thanks to our media intern, India Yarborough, and also the Center for Environmental Law at the University of New Orleans. You're listening, of course, to the immortal Woody Guthrie, and our theme music comes courtesy of Lobo Loco. Take care.
Good people, what are we waiting on?
You've been listening to Connect the Dots podcast by the Center for Progressive Reform. We're a legal policy center helping to build healthy communities, safe workplaces, and a more resilient planet. Check us out and subscribe to our podcast by visiting our website, www.progressivereform.org. Thanks. See you there.